Hello, and welcome to She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Bethany, and today I want to tell you a little bit about the interview you'll be hearing in just a moment. First, a bit of housekeeping. I want to say that we have a few audio issues, so please forgive the snaps, crackles, and pops that you may encounter. We're working on getting some better equipment so that we can provide you with the best listening experience. I also want to say that this is the final interview in our series on LGBT in academia, and it's packed full of interesting tidbits for you. As always, we'll be posting some accompanying links, etc. on our Facebook page, so please make sure that you check those out. Our interviewee today is Nancy Matthews, interviewed by our own Elizabeth. Nancy is currently a part-time faculty member at Cal State Long Beach, and she's going on her 13th year there, meaning she has loads of experience in the field and was able to provide us with some excellent insight into how to be allies on our own campuses in particular. Listening to the interview, it's not hard to see why Nancy is well-liked by so many of her students. They've described her as energetic, very caring, and inspirational, and hearing her talk about her experiences, both as a lesbian in academia and as a source of support for her students as she tries to establish a safe space for them, made me wish that I had had her as a professor as well. As you listen to this interview, I'd encourage each and every one of you, whether or not you're in academia, to think about what defines activism. It can be easy to think of activism as these people who go out and join protests and meet with legislators to try to affect change. But the Cambridge Dictionary defines activism as the use of direct and noticeable action to achieve a result, usually a political or social one. Activism doesn't always have to involve marching down a street holding a sign. It can be simple but clear acts that say, "Here is a safe space for you to talk with me because I know the world hasn't made it acceptable yet, and I am going to make it acceptable by creating it myself." Activism involves intentional actions, and that can be done anywhere. In the classroom, in the workspace, in your home, at those Christmas dinners where everyone gets drunk and asks invasive questions about what you're doing with your life. Anyway, activism can be anywhere and anything with intent and mindfulness that you are creating a safe space for those around you and for yourself, shaping a new and better future for the world with your singular actions. Anyway, enough from me. We hope that you enjoy today's interview, and without further ado, welcome to the episode.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Maybe you can introduce yourself and give a little bit of your background.
My name is Nancy Matthews, and my current position?
Yeah.
So I'm on the faculty at Cal State Long Beach in the College of Health and Human Services and with the Department of Recreation and Leisure Studies.
Okay.
And my position currently is evolving a little bit because this will be my 12th year. I'm going into my 13th year. So I taught at Cal State Long Beach for 12 years. And I came in as an adjunct faculty member. And for the last 6+ years, I've been still adjunct, but teaching more than a full load, 5 classes a semester. And I was recently told that now I will become a full-time lecturer.
I have just a question about, as contingent faculty, how does that work in the Cal State system, actually? Because I know that there have been, within the UC system, in the Cal State system, there have been issues with contingent faculty.
Oh, there's issues.
Has that impacted you?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's issues everywhere, right?
Yeah. So it impacts everyone, and probably in different ways, and private colleges are not immune as well, and sadly, it's becoming more of an issue for private colleges as well. But within the Cal State system, apparently people can be brought on in, well, two specific ways, tenure track or lecturer. But within lecturer, you can come in as a full-time position or as an adjunct position, and mostly people are coming in as adjunct. And the contract goes from a semester.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you've done that for at least 2 years, sometimes more, then you might be eligible for a year contract. And that year contract doesn't mean that you're guaranteed anything. It simply means that you are supposed to be offered classes before it's off the street.
Okay.
And so after the semester evolves into a year, which generally is at least two semesters or more, that year for at least 2 years or more could evolve next into a three-year contract, which again doesn't have any stability. It just means that if there's money, if there are students, if we want to offer that class and want you to teach that class, we may give you that. Yeah. And then after apparently two at least years of a three-year contract where you teach a full load or more, you are eligible then for the full-time lecturer position, which again does not guarantee you anything.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, contingent faculty is one of my hobby horses because I have so, I mean, it's a real problem. There's excess of PhDs who are desperate for jobs. And I think the national average is about $3,000 a class, and you can't live on that.
Right.
And if our students knew that most of their classes were being taught by people who make $3,000 per class, if their parents knew that they wonder where their money was going.
Agree in some way with what you're saying. And then I also think that there are students and parents that might not care because within our culture, and the only reason I'm thinking about our culture a little bit more is I also volunteer and do a literacy program in my community. And people from other countries, particularly Asian countries, have this immense respect for educators. And so I actually think in our culture, we might not be as flabbergasted.
We might not care.
It may just be the norm. Not that there's any judgment about whether they're not caring or not. But I do know that as a person who has been full time, at least, I make half what a bus driver makes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and when you factor
in... And I don't want to...
No.
Demean the bus driver position or whatever, or any of the necessity, but I'm like...
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, and you hear these stories about people being on welfare while they're trying to teach, while they're teaching a full load between two or three different universities, and it's really hard. I feel super fortunate that I have a tenure track job, but there's...
And I think it's incumbent upon tenure track faculty to also be not only cognizant, but also advocates.
Absolutely.
Because it's the entire system. All of it. The weakest link weakens the whole system. And there's something terribly wrong with the direction that this is going in higher ed overall.
Yeah.
And now that it's really become an issue in private institutions as well, you're like, whoa, is there no limits?
Yeah. Okay, so back to what we're talking about here. So we talked about your role in academia. What do you have you had any struggles or discrimination because, well, first... Where
How
do you
I identify?
How do you identify? And what are your pronouns?
Okay, all right. So I identify as lesbian. My pronouns are she, her. And a lot of that is generational.
Sure.
Because I was born in 1963. I'm currently 53, going on 54. And so a lot of it has to do with my generation. But also just kind of segueing with our previous discussion about adjunct, I kind of wonder, you know, the intersectionality of all of this and the classism within academia with tenure track and lecturers and administration and where the power lies, how many people who identify in these traditionally oppressed populations are not afforded the tenure track positions, but fill the quota so that the institution looks like it's got the numbers, but are given positions that have essentially no power.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I think I see a lot of people who are cisgendered, straight, you know, heterosexual, and they're struggling. But I can imagine with the intersectional identities, you know, depending on race, depending on identification, like that they're. That's a whole nother level, and that I don't have to think about, but that when I say it, of course, that makes perfect sense.
And then, because of that population, you know, it's not just those multiple layers. It's just that if you are that kind of person, if you're a person of color, blah, 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 this is what you're eligible for.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we'll give you this, you know, adjunct position. And
the institution gets, you know, just like the student here.
Yeah.
On the cover of our brochures as this symbol of diversity.
Yeah.
Yet not receiving the kinds of support and...
Yeah, I mean, and that happens with first generation. I mean, and she was first generation college student too, so
international, person of color,
and not getting the support that she needs on campus, even though, you know, they say that that support will be offered to students.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So, what struggles or discriminations have you faced because you're a lesbian in academia, or have you? Do you feel like you have?
It's interesting. At Cal State Long Beach, in many ways, I don't feel like I have. But part of that is just about my person and my personality. And I may not attribute it in that way. Certainly I've had struggles, and I think more of it I attribute to being adjunct. But again, if being adjunct is a subset of or is connected to the status and those who in the higher ups say this, then that is a direct result and it is connected. So I don't see a lot of direct to me. Certainly on any kind of vibrant college campus, there are ignorant people and people from the outside that come onto a state campus and espouse different views. And in my place in life now, I can look at that as sort of their ignorance and use that as a teachable moment for my students. And just to sort of talk through not only students who are struggling with who they are, but other students that might say, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's what my parents say.
Yeah.
And to say, okay, all right, let's talk a little bit about that. So so I don't think that I've had anything direct. And I feel that I'm on a pretty progressive campus.
That's great.
But it doesn't mean that there aren't people that have feelings.
Sure.
But I haven't felt the kinds of things like I felt.
You felt at Scripps.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really? Well, what year did you graduate from Scripps?
87.
87. And you felt like there was, at Scripps, there was discrimination against...
Oh, it wasn't a feeling.
It wasn't a feeling. It was overt.
Yeah. I mean, when an administrator goes around campus in the light of day, gleefully taking down the pink triangles, posters, and then when confronted says... Are you, this is inappropriate. Do you know that this is Parents Weekend coming up?
Wow.
And where the rest of the administration doesn't then take a stand and do anything. And we don't, you know, and I look as president of the student body at the time, and I look at our statement on discrimination, and we are not listed as a protected class, whereas most institutions at that point, we're starting to look at those things.
Sure.
And we pride ourselves on being on the cutting edge.
Yeah.
And so you could say, well, that's okay. There's always a starting point. But when confronted, the institution said, no, we're not ready.
Do you feel like your experiences as a student have made you more kind of aware and able to provide better support to your own students?
Well, yes.
Of course.
I mean, I would say, I would think that you would echo the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That all of our experiences, who we are, we try to translate that and to make sense of some things.
Yeah.
And certainly qualify it as our experience and our time.
Yes, yes.
But I think all of that is really helpful in making sense of things and problem solving with other students and commiserating. And so... Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, because you having that experience with the administration would make you maybe more sensitive as a faculty member, even though you're in a contingent. I mean, that's the question, though. Like, you have this desire to be more supportive of, you know, maybe LGBTQ students, but you're a contingent faculty member. So if the administration is, like, at odds with that, there's a fear that you may not have a job next time.
Right, right. Now, the bottom line is, I don't actually care.
What the administration says?
A little bit. I'm at a place in my life where the meager parcel of, you know, economic security that's provided is not meaningful.
Sure.
And so so I'm not at a place of abject poverty if I weren't provided with this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fantastic place to be in.
Yeah.
But I have to continue to remind myself that I cannot sit back and say that any of this is okay.
Yeah.
Just because I can still survive, because someone else may not be able to. Yeah. And certainly someone that's at the beginning of their career absolutely couldn't. Yeah. I was able to make great money in Parks and Recreation, which is the lowest, you know, in terms of security, in terms of budget, within the private sector and public sector. And that was boatloads of money in comparison to this.
Sure.
So again, I have to kind of remind myself that while I can survive and my focus is certainly not on any kind of economic security, mm-hmm. I have enough security.
Yeah.
And I have to be mindful of others.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Do you feel welcome in academia generally as a lesbian?
As a lesbian, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. So, I pause because there are elements over my course, and let me also paraphrase that my first jobs out of Scripps were in higher ed environment, but I was in student services.
Okay.
And so, in student services, we'll tend to be a little bit more evolved than most of the faculty because of the nature of what we do in our function. Mm-hmm. So more of my pausing has to do with the adjunct status.
Okay.
So as lesbian, as a woman, I think I'm okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
And I think that's a lot about Long Beach, because Long Beach tends as a city mm-hmm. and as an institution to be pretty good.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's really good. So I guess, what do you think maybe is the best thing that allies can do? So, you know, I am not on the spectrum of LGBTQ, you know, I'm not part of that community, but I hope I'm an ally to my friends who are. I'm also hope that as a tenure line faculty member, I'm an ally to my faculty. You know, in my department this last semester, I tried to make sure that we were scheduled for classes that meant that we didn't have too many preps each semester, you know, in this semester, so that my colleague who's teaching four classes didn't have four preps along with
right.
it. You know, those kind of little, you know, I do my part, hopefully, to be able to provide relief for my fellow contract faculty, because they have pretty good contracts at my institution. But I guess as an ally toward adjunct faculty, but also toward LGBTQ, you know, faculty and students on campus, what do you think the most important things that allies can do?
Well, I think part of it is to be visible. And some of that visibility might be having an ally sticker on your door, or putting some kind of statement, or even if your institution has an ally program that you've gone through, mm-hmm. and oftentimes there is a visible sticker
yep.
that you receive, that you put that on your syllabi. So that, and if you go through other ally programs, like I put down the VetNet ally program, the Autism ally program, the Undocumented ally program, and Safe Zone on my syllabus, so that students not only see that as, oh my God, yes, and I've got a resource, mm-hmm. but that might open up another door that if I don't have a sticker that, you know, relates to their struggle or their concern, that they might say, ooh, this person seems to have quite a bit going on here.
Yeah.
They might just be an ally overall.
Sure, sure.
And really open to talking about something that they might not know anything about. So I would say visibility is really mm-hmm. important. And then to ask questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just to be there, to be visible, and that way another person can approach you.
That's, I think that's important. I hope I try to do that.
I know.
At Ball State, where I teach, we had just had a whole discussion among the faculty council about adding a kind of non-discrimination thing into the syllabi and to encourage
Good.
Faculty to do that. But at the Faculty Senate, a lot of the older professors were like, well, I don't want to make my syllabus any longer. Why is this important? And it was, they talked about this, I think, for three different Faculty Senate sessions. And it's just, it's a no-brainer to me. Like, of right. course, like, give me the language that I should be putting on my syllabus and I'll put it on there, because I want students to know that, like, they can come to me and whatever. But
right. Oh, how interesting. And
I mean, in Indiana is different than Long Beach, right? I mean,
right, but, and you totally get, because my syllabus has, I don't know, probably 6 pages of policies.
Sure.
But you go, how hard is that?
Yeah.
And so you just sort of stick it in there. And then each year, as our language might change, you just zhuzh it up.
Yeah.
And now you, I don't know.
I know, copy and paste it, put it on the syllabus. Right. I'm not distributing it via paper anyway, so it's not like I'm killing any more trees.
Right, and I'm not, I don't know, yeah. So it's a really pretty easy thing.
And
so,
it's a small thing that you can
and
do.
And a big thing.
Yeah.
Right? Such a meaningful thing. Although, how many of our students actually read the syllabus?
That's true.
And so you look at that and you go, I'd say if I were going to fall on the sword, I might look at content more than the syllabus. But then I think the conversation in Academic Senate is really important for them to sort of perhaps confront a deeper issue, which
yes.
is not that it takes additional time, but that they're just really not getting yeah. why it's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's already a campus policy, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Of
and so
course
it's already, is. There's already something in there that says, by participating in this class, I agree to all the campus policies
yes.
and I will da 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 da. But it's asking that you do something additional.
Yeah.
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 Interesting.
Yeah. No, I found that really interesting. And yeah.
How did it resolve?
They gave us two different statements, a short one and a long one. And they said, it's not mandatory, but if you want to put it in your syllabus, it's available to you. So, you know, for those who feel like their syllabus is getting too long and they don't want to add it, that's fine. They probably weren't going to be allies anyway, so.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting.
But for
yeah.
those of us who want to make sure that our students know that we are allies, you know.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I would look at that as a really nice win.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I think
yeah.
so too.
Yeah.
Are you an activist in any way? It's a tough question because you might not think of your activism as being activism.
Okay. Yes. But it feels a little weird.
Yeah.
Because, you know, through my life, the various ways that I've been an activist, so this may feel like it pales in comparison, but just being, you know, just being open and honest and vulnerable, I think is part of the defining elements of being an activist, because you're being kind of open and transparent and
sure.
and that opens you up to some stuff, which means that it generates questions and some issues. And so you have to kind of respond
yeah.
in some way or not respond. And that is also a response. So yeah, yeah, yeah. And to be really more specific, with LGBTQ issues and concerns on campuses, I was one of the founding members to reinstate the Ally program at Cal State Long Beach. So we had a new dean in my college, the College of Health and Human Services, who was coming from Florida, or no, was kind of reminded of what was at other institutions. He's like, how come we don't have something like this here? And it was part of the counseling program, mm-hmm. which has its own issues, I think. And those folks didn't have time or perhaps continued interest. I think it's more time to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of fell by the wayside. So he was asking the question, and a group of four of us came together and we're like, yeah, well, we can do this.
Yeah.
And so we're all faculty and one staff member. And then we formed a small committee of maybe six people then, and have since developed a really nice, I think, safe zone program for our campus, which several years ago, the CSU adopted for the 23 campuses.
Oh, nice.
And so that's a nice feather in the cap for Cal State Long Beach. And I would say that that's a good tool, and it's an element of activism.
Yeah.
By having that available.
Absolutely. And it's an intersection of your, you know, your work life and your personal life and activism all kind of rolled into one.
Yes.
It's nice
yeah.
when that kind of, they kind of come together.
Yes. Yes.
So I would assume that you would rate the support for LGBTQI students on Cal State Long Beach's campus pretty good.
Good in some sectors and during some time periods. So I would say for students, there are resources but there are students that are unaware of resources. Mm-hmm. So again, the visibility becomes really important. So if there are some students in, whether it's particular disciplines or their awareness is just a little less than others, they might not feel like it's an open and affirming campus because they're just not aware. Mm-hmm. And it's largely a commuter campus. But even though it's in Long Beach, which many people would say is sort of a gay mecca, if they're just not aware of it, then they're not going to feel it.
Sure.
So, and there have been time periods. Our prior president was really not an advocate and certainly not affirming of faculty, LGBT issues, and actively worked against many policy changes. And so you'd say, president, and so how could this be a great campus? Because there are so many other people that are really good.
Sure, sure.
So it's such a big campus that there's definitely going to be people that feel and have issues, and there have been certainly issues on our campus. Several years ago, there was an incident where a trans person was confronted in a restroom, and the letters "it" were carved into their chest, and so
that's really hard.
Yeah, and so.
So they were attacked in the bathroom?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, that's awful.
Yeah. So it just feels really weird that we've just been talking about how great
counseling. Yeah, sure.
But it is, and that has also happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even in the most supportive of environments, things can happen. I assume that person got support and help and...
Yes,
And that maybe policies, I don't know. What happened in the aftermath of that?
It's unclear because some of that is
private.
It does need to remain private. And of course, some things get taken out of context and there's a little bit of rumor. But other issues, like at the rec center where locker room talk... they've now developed programs where there is a training program, and they now have institutionalized that all of their staff will go through the Safe Zone program.
Nice.
And in fact, our chief of police 3 years ago approached us and said, I want to be delicate about how I'm asking this, but I really want all of my officers to go through this, but I'd like to ask that you do it just for them. And we're like,
sure.
Yes, absolutely. And we were terrified because we're like, these people carry guns.
Yes.
But, and also it was the first group of people that were going to go through the Safe Zone Ally program that didn't sign themselves up.
Sure. And it was a mandatory program.
So there was this whole dimension, but it was a great program. And so while there are issues, there have also been some really good responses. And so as an institution, our evolution is continuing.
Yeah. What do you think could be done maybe to support students and faculty more? What would you like to, if you had your dream world of ally support and institutional support and those kinds of things, what do you think would be the best thing that you would like to see?
Good question. Well, let me start with a couple of things that we've done and then more directly answer that. So our campus has been able to identify areas where it was able to, admittedly, in a very easy way, create gender-neutral restrooms. Mm-hmm. Because that is probably one of the biggest safety concerns for a trans person. But even
for masculine presenting, like lesbians who identify as women, and like I know several women who have been, you know, who have been in women's restrooms, and people have told them to get out because they're men, and it's like I'm a woman, like just because I kind of present maybe a little more masculine doesn't mean that this isn't the bathroom that am to use.
Yes. Yeah. And fortunately or not, I haven't been confronted in that way yet. I kind of feel like I'm sort of a candidate.
Yeah,
but
sure.
So we're never going to be able to create a complete environment that is safe and affirming, or affirming, because we can, I think, achieve safety.
Yeah.
But we're going to be met with ignorance. And we are. That's part of why we're in education, yeah. right? And so ignorance doesn't have to be ugly. It's just not knowing.
Sure.
And so if we're creating an environment that is visible and saying that openness and vulnerability is okay, and it's where a lot of growth happens, then that's where all the learning occurs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So back to your question about what can we do? I think more spaces make sense. Mm-hmm. So our campus is like many others where there are spaces that might be for students of color, or more specifically a Black student center or a student union. Mm-hmm. So whether we're looking at race and ethnicity, religion, women versus mm-hmm. men, but really kind of looking at the typically oppressed group mm-hmm. and creating a space sure. that is safe and affirming. So there is an LGBTQ center on campus, but it's the only one that actually doesn't have staff. And so you look at that as policy.
Yeah.
Sure. There's an opportunity. So having that staff, now we certainly do have a multicultural coordinator.
Yeah.
Person identify, well, actually, they just got scooped up by Pomona College.
Oh, goodness.
But person of color that is just so... so smart and worldly and just welcoming.
Yeah.
And also identifies as a gay man. So having the right people in the right positions, but again, look at his position. Great that we have it, but he's being asked to do like four positions.
Sure.
And is that because we don't care enough about those things, or is it also because he is gay?
Because he has an intersectional identity, yes. and he fits a lot of boxes.
Right, he fits all those boxes, and we're used to kind of fully oppressing those people as well.
Sure.
So, the
idea that, what do you think about, there's a Black student, there might be a Black student union and a gay and lesbian or LGBTQ center,
right.
but what if you are a, Black and LGBTQ? Where's your intersectional space
right.
of support?
So, yeah, and we're both white women, and
yeah.
we're like, okay, so when you think about the multicultural center, we might automatically exclude ourselves from that because
sure.
we think of culture as race, but culture could be our gender.
Sure.
And whether our gender identity is cisgendered or has to do with sexual orientation, we have to realize that a lot of times these cultural centers are for people who have not had a historic voice
mm-hmm.
and power. And so as women, we're sure. candidates.
Sure, yeah.
So I think it's about educating us, in our generations, mm-hmm. but also current students, and maybe they might not need this as much as we do, to say that culture is far beyond race and ethnicity.
Yeah.
And that so that multicultural center is that center where the intersection of these experiences came together.
Do you see the various groups kind of coming together and working together?
I don't think I know enough.
Okay.
I'm kind of in my role in my classes, and I may not know enough
okay.
about that. You could probably ask someone else, and they're like, oh my God.
Yeah, do this and this and this together.
So I might, yeah. So I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. But, but even to be able to say, I'm not quite sure, but that's an interesting question. And I'm interested, if a student came to you and said like, oh, do you know if there's a thing for, Black lesbians on campus? And you say, I don't know if there is, but check it out and
yes.
Whatever.
Yes. Yeah. So I could say, well, here's what I do know.
Yeah.
And then here's a couple of people that might know a little bit more. And then when you go to these places, there's other people that are going to know a ton more as well, and just realize that none of that is a whole story.
Yeah, absolutely. They give us so many pieces of paper when we become at the beginning of the semester, when you first kind of come into a university, and it's the information is so overwhelming.
Yeah.
But there are new policies and new programs being developed by different groups on campus all the time. So, just making yourself aware of those things, or knowing at least where to point a student.
Yeah. Well, and also, you just said it, and with our students, they might not realize this, but just to let them know, hey, if you don't see it, and if it's actually just not there, then just create it. Yeah. And here's how.
Yeah. I mean, they can be leaders that and they can get support from the administration to be leaders. I mean, yeah. it's emotionally draining, I think, for a lot of students to be those leaders and to be in those leadership positions when they're confronted with, you know, pushback on it, or when they're, you know, trying to do their studies and be a leader in their, you know, identity community or whatever. But knowing that there's support from faculty, from the administration, from, you know, whomever, I think that's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of goes back to that visibility. Yeah. So you see, oh, well, it's here, and here's support mechanisms and resources. Yeah. And also other people that might have done some of this, and it doesn't have to be all encompassing, like all consuming.
Yeah. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, wouldn't that be an awesome experience for some students and you know, the student who's never been involved in clubs and organizations, yeah, and doesn't perceive themselves as a leader, mm-hmm, that they have that opportunity to just sort of like try it out.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, what could come of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I think we're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Good. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hiya, Beth here again. I just want to thank you so much for listening to today's interview, and I hope that you found it as inspirational and motivational as I did. Before we close out today's episode, I just want to highlight a few things from the interview. Nancy mentioned that she has a few stickers that she includes in her syllabi: LGBT, VetNet, Autism Awareness, and Undocumented Immigrants. These are ways that she can show that she is a safe person for anyone going through these journeys to talk to, and it's a simple, unthreatening way to open herself up to any students who may be looking for someone to talk to as they work through this transition into higher education. She raised an important question as well. As academics create their syllabi for this upcoming year, is it more important to cut down on the length of the syllabus or to create this safe space for students? While most American institutions have already begun the academic year, I know that here in the UK and in many other European countries, it's not too late to add a short little snippet to your course handbook, letting students know that you are available to them. In the US, I'd encourage you to think about how you can let your students know that you are a safe space for them, even if it's just adding an ally sticker to your office door, if you're lucky enough to have one, or incorporating a little note at the bottom of a class email. Regardless of whether or not you're in academia, there are a few things that you can do to let others know that you are an ally that don't involve wearing a rainbow shirt with ally splayed across it in huge letters, although if you want to do that, please feel free and we'd love to see pictures. You can do simple things, though, like finding out if there's an LGBT center near you, attend LGBT-centered events, look into attending Pride events nearby. Your physical presence as an ally is considerably stronger than you may think. If you're in academia and you sponsor a club or society, perhaps think about ways you can partner with active LGBT groups or organizations to create those safe spaces for students. Try to shut down homophobic, transphobic, racist remarks, comments, jokes, assumptions. Even if everyone present is cis, white, hetero, it's about taking down those stereotypes and language in order to construct a more positive environment everywhere. Find ally stickers for those groups you want to support, like LGBT or VetNet, whatever you're trying to establish, and post them on your desk, your door, anywhere in your workplace where those looking will find it. Or find ally buttons and pin them onto your backpack, briefcase, purse, cardigan, coat, endless spaces. You can even add a little safe space line to your email signature. Remember that part of creating a safe space is making sure that you don't out someone who has confided in you. So keep a closed door policy and agree that whatever is said in that safe space stays in that safe space. Finally, I really want to encourage you to remember to signpost anyone who needs assistance that is outside of your jurisdiction. Part of this means recognizing your own limits. While you may advocate for, say, bisexuality, someone looking for mental health support really should be referred to groups or services who specialize in that kind of support. Listening and opening up the conversation with someone is a great starting point. Just make sure that you don't take too much on yourself or try to sort out someone's life in ways that aren't your area of expertise. Make a list for yourself of centers or organizations that operate locally. In some cases for academics, you may want to see if your campus has such groups or if you have a students' union that might have some services available in order to get people connected locally. We'll be posting some resources that may help you find some things like buttons and stickers to use in your offices or workspaces, as well as some information on how to establish safe spaces, particularly for LGBT students. As always, we welcome your ideas and resources as well, so please do share them with us. If you have anything you'd like to add, we just want to remind you that we have a Facebook discussion group for our podcast, and you can find us on Facebook by searching for She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. You can also send us an email at shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at shewhopersistedpod and Instagram at shewhopersisted. You can also find more resources from this interview and past episodes at www.shewhopersisted.com. Finally, we would love it if you would rate and review us on Facebook and iTunes, as this allows other people to find us more easily and see what we're all about. Again, thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and as always, stay nasty.